Hello there. Welcome back to the return of the dialogues. I'm John Brooks, and today I'm speaking with my partners in crime and spirituality, Mike Slavin and Eric Brown. At the moment, lockdown restrictions in the UK, where I'm based, are starting to ease and life is returning to something resembling normality. So we all have a lot on our mind. There's a lot going on in the world. And four topics that came up for me personally was the topic of play, the topic of social skills, the topic of flow, and the topic of depression, all things that I've been thinking about and fleshing out in my own understanding throughout the lockdown period and afterward. So I hope you enjoy this free-flowing discussion where me and the other High Existence team members discuss the impact of coming out of the COVID lockdown situation, the idea of the upward versus the downward spiral, the medicinal power of video games, how we can use emotional reward to increase our productivity, how competition can increase bonding instead of actually creating enemies, the fact that being alive is worth a celebration in and of itself, the stoic approach to being successful. As you know, I am a huge fan of stoicism, and I teach and I write about it a lot. The secret to being a great friend, how to handle neediness and rejection in yourself and others, and tons more. That list of things you can expect does not do this conversation justice. I really hope you just dive in and let us know what you think. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review telling us what you thought of it and give us a rating, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any future dialogues. With all that said, let's crack into today's episode.
We're live.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
So yeah, like we were discussing what to discuss when it came to the return of the dialogues. And I was just thinking, what's alive for me? And I'm sort of now coming out of a lockdown that's been, you know, 4 months plus. I think in Wales, we had harsher lockdown restrictions than England. Like we were pretty confined for a long time. And I've learned a lot, as I'm sure you guys have, in your experience of being restricted and social distancing and things. And the four terms that came up for me was play, flow, social skills, and depression. And it's funny how, EB, you say that they are linked, because they're all kind of like circling around in my consciousness at this very moment. What came up for you when you saw those four words?
Immediately I notice there's like pairs where two complement each other very well. You know, depression can be taking things overly serious, giving a great weight to things that might not necessarily deserve that level of just involvement, cognitive involvement, physical involvement from you. And again, a lot of people who are super depressed have this, there's this metaphor of like you're carrying around a very heavy weight all the time. Or the one I like is like you're wading through hip deep water. Like everything is just more difficult. And immediately you have on the other side of that play, which requires you take it seriously, but under the assumption that it's all a game, it's for fun, there's a lightness, there's a teamwork to it. And so like there's a pairing there. And then the same thing with social skills or social anxiety and flow state. Flow requires you to get out of rumination, out of your head, and just into and moving and dancing with what is coming up. And that's where, at least I feel, people struggle in like social situations. They think like, what do I have to say now? Should I smile? Am I smiling too much? Is this eye contact too long? And it's like, you're in your head too much, bro. Like, come down, flow with what's going on. And so those things also pair up. And I think there's a way, and maybe we'll will discover the buried treasure in this conversation, that there's like a thread or a through line that actually just links all four of these together. Immediately what's coming up is a recent hobby horse of mine, the idea of the upward spiral, right? Everyone knows the downward spiral, most prominently with stuff like addiction, like you just go and you hit rock bottom. If there's a downward spiral, there's an upward one. And what does that look like? It's like all four of these things feeding on each other, just making stuff better and better and better, and you become stronger and you grow. I don't exactly know what all the connections are that would do that, but right when you messaged us those four words, I was like, yeah, they're all overlapping. You can picture like a four Venn diagram, circles overlapping, and it's like, what is right in the middle of that? That was mostly a feeling, but in trying to articulate it, like it feels like there's something there.
Yeah. And one of the things I see is it's to ground this in experiences people might be having right now. I felt depressed in my life. I'm sure you guys have felt depressed various times in your life. Probably everyone who listens to this has some point or another felt depressed. And when I think of those other three components, depression is in some ways the absence of those things. Not exclusively, there are other things that you could throw in there, but the absence of play, the absence of flow, the absence of social skills, which then lend themselves to relationships, nourishing relationships. Without those things, it's very easy to slip into a state of depression. There's a loss of meaning. And I think there's a real important combination and fusion between the gravity of life, there's a meaningfulness and a seriousness that you're kind of alluding to a little bit, Eric, where people get overly stuck in that mode sometimes when they're feeling depressed, when lacking the buoyancy. And I think a vivid experience of life actually is a marriage of the two. You need to be able to see the lightness and carry levity in just the madness of being alive, as well as getting in touch with the grief and the devastation that comes with being a human on this planet. And both of those experiences are real and can exist, you know, simultaneously inside of our whatever kind of context we're going through. Like a breakup, for instance, can feel on one hand completely maddening and just like ridiculously absurd and liberating. And there's a lightness that can be held with it, but there's also the heartbreak that is felt in the deeper waters. So I see all of those things as relevant. And I wonder if it might be useful to go, keeping in mind this idea of, you know, depression being possibly the absence of these three things, among other things, what is it we can do to invite greater playfulness? What is it we can do to invite flow states into our experience of daily life? What are the small adjustments we can make to our social skills that can allow for the birth and the flourishing of really warm and growth-oriented relationships? These are some of the questions I think will be worth pursuing as we continue this dialogue.
Yeah, to build on that, one question that I would put out there for anyone listening and to you guys as well is, if you think back over the last couple of weeks of your life, are there any things that stand out to you as things you purposely did for no other reason than to play and have fun? You know, yep. Because I think that's like a really super important concept, because it's so easy to get lost in this trap of like being productive, improving, self-actualizing. And I think self-actualization, or the path to self-actualization without play, is you're talking about a downward spiral, actually. So one of the things that I believe is that, like, things like video games, if they're used wisely, can be like medicine. And I sometimes like almost like force myself to play a video game for half an hour or an hour, because they're basically these like structured flow environments where you can just like, okay, you have a challenge, you have a set of skills that are nicely matched, and you just dip into flow for like half an hour, providing that doesn't like take over your life and you use it as a sense of reward. I actually feel like my mood baseline raises when I play video games for like an hour a day. It's just an easy way to slip into that flow state through play. So yeah, what do you guys have to say about, are there any things that stand out to you in the last couple of weeks as that you did purely for the fun of it, for the flow?
I have some answers to this question, and I'll probably let Eric dive in if he has an answer. But quickly, I want to speak to the point around video games, because it's such an interesting piece, because I think I agree with you that they can be really valuable if there's because it's a structured kind of achievement, and you can go through this process of feeling like rewarded and watching yourself become better. Now, as long as it's limited, what I think people get stuck in is that becomes the primary and sole source of a sense of mastery that they have in their life. And there's very little cross application, if any, to the actual material reality. So they find themselves getting better and better at something, but then it doesn't actually make contact with the world around them. And so their life experience doesn't get much better. And so I think the video game piece is true, as long as there are other paths to mastery that a person is interacting with. They're also doing jujitsu, or they're working on a skill, or they're practicing or training in something that makes more direct contact with the material consequences of their life. And for some people, that can be really a hard balance to strike. If there isn't one of those easily within arm's reach, it's just so much easier to go grab the controller and get that sense of satisfaction from the game, rather than pursuing another domain or world to gain that satisfaction. And I find that you, John, have multiple domains from which you can gain that satisfaction. And video games exists among those options. That's my sense, at least, of the life that you live. I'm not following you around in Wales, so I can't say for sure. but yeah, I can speak to the fun thing, but I want to give the floor to Eric here for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll add on the video game thing really quickly before what came up to Mike's question. Stephen Kotler and the Flow Genome Project guys have a really important point, particularly with video games, is that flow is actually the only state you can get in where all five of the really potent neurochemicals are released. Like, if you're, I don't know, doing really addictive drugs, or you're doing like festivals, they release like two or three at a time. Flow is literally the only state that does all five at once. And so it's quite literally like the most addictive thing you can do. And that's why people become like, what do you call them? Adrenaline junkies, stuff like that. Like, always looking for that state, because it is literally one of the greatest states you can be in. The tricky part with video games, much like social media, is they are so finely tuned to induce that state in you that you just get completely lost. And it's actually a very hard thing to break. So it's like almost everything, right? It's like everything in moderation. Like, it's incredible, but be warned. There's the slippery slope is very easy to start sliding down with video game stuff, because they are so uniquely effective at inducing flow state. So that's video game stuff. What came up when Mike asked about like practices or activities was actually for me a reframing that I think brings lightness. And again, this is one of those things that actually has to get into your body. You can't just nod along and say, yeah, I understand this intellectually. You actually have to feel it. But it's, you're not obligated to do anything in life. Like, nothing at all. To the point of, like, you're not even obligated to keep living, which I think is one of the ways a lot of people are driven to suicide, right? It's like, I feel chained to destiny, and I have no control over what's happening. So I will do the one single thing I feel like I can do, which is rebel against destiny and be like, no, fuck you, I'm leaving, peace. But this applies to like everything. Like if you were born in Western developed culture, like you're not obligated to go to school, go to university, get a good job, have a family. You could straight up just peace out and travel the world, go live in New Zealand. Like it, no, you know, you're not obligated to be the same person for your friends that you were yesterday. You're not obligated to serve your family. And that switch of, oh, everything in my life I get to choose. And also everything in my life I can drop if I don't want to do it. Once that, at least I feel like if you can actually truly feel that, like, wow, I get to choose all of this. And that's extremely empowering. Everything becomes a little lighter because there's always this background recognition of like, yeah, you know, if this is not working for me, I can leave. I don't know if there's a, I'm sure there is a list of practices you could distill from that overarching recognition, but it's currently a little fuzzy.
Yeah, I think that's an insight that I've had as well, and it can be a challenging one to digest, because we almost get something out of believing that we are forced and coerced into, you know. And the feeling of being coerced is very real. The actual scope of our choice is much, much wider than we commonly like to imagine. And because then the weight of the responsibility of our own hand in architecting the life that we live, it seems more clear. There's so much that a person can do, you know, in today's day and age. If you want to travel, I don't have any money, well, go travel and do, you know, figure out a way that you can Uber in that city for a day and then use the money that you made that day to, you know, live the next day. And then just, you know, there's all kinds of opportunities people can be creative about generating income. Remote work is more, you know, available than ever before. There's so much that can be done given the technology that's at our disposal. But it's easy to become complacent and just kind of nod along and almost feel sorry for ourselves for being trapped in a life that we felt like we were forced into. And a lot of ways, you know, like we just kind of arrive on this planet and then we're being shaped by the various contexts we're exposed to. But at a certain point, we can see the world and we can make choices that can materially affect those contexts that are shaping us. We could choose into new contexts that we believe would be more nourishing and better for us. And so at a certain point, we can't just, you know, sit around feeling sorry for ourselves that, you know, we are in a certain way or trapped in a certain place. There's always moves to be made. And there are a lot of moves that we don't even see in our purview because we would then have to give up something. We'd have to give up the narrative that we're stuck or that we're trapped or something like that. But to shift gears a little bit, to circle back to John's question about what is something I've done recently to have fun, I've been in an interesting mode because recently moved into a new house with roommates, and it's a really good sort of communal vibe, and we're trying to make this space something really enjoyable. And I've been thinking about what are the things that we can bring in, particularly to have fun, to inspire a sense of playfulness. I want this house to feel like it invites people into playfulness. So went out and bought, and particularly, you know, it's the summer, so it's a good reason to be outside and things like that. And we have a nice yard space, so just getting different games to play. It's as simple as getting games. It doesn't need to be anything highfalutin or you know, super conscious. Just getting... Where I'm from, it's called cornhole. Other people might call it bags, but you toss these bean bags into wooden boards. We built the wooden boards because one of my roommates is very crafty, and I just ordered the bags on Amazon, and now we can play that. And I also bought spike ball, which is a really interesting game that has been invented sometime in the past few years. Some people may have seen it. People play it in parks, but it's kind of like a stand-in. It's like a volleyball net that looks like a mini trampoline. It's kind of hard to describe, but there's all of these different games or, you know, and when you look at these things, it's like, what are they? What are they physically? We got a wooden board with a hole in it and some bean bags. And that creates a whole context to have fun, you know, inside of. So, and just the other night, I was sitting with some friends and I had this urge to do something, not just sit around and have a conversation. So I'm a magician, and I went and grabbed both of my magic hats and a bunch of old cards and put the hats turned upside down, like across the room, and just gave my friends some cards, and we saw like who could get the cards into the hat, you know. And there's all different kinds of simple playfulness that you can invite into an interaction that usually we don't reach for that option because, oh, would that be weird, or is that something that I can do? Board games are another thing. There's all kinds of ways we can invite a sense of fun and play that used to be our complete, like, that used to be how I operated, like, all the time when I was a child. Just, oh, what can I play? What can I do now? What is it that I can play? And I worry that, I forget which one of you is speaking to it, but as, I think it was you, Eric, related to this whole piece around obligation, as we grow up and we begin to build this identity of, I'm a grown up and I'm an adult, we begin to suffocate the parts of ourself that feel too childish to actually bring out and invite. And that's actually a mistake, because mm-hmm. our work is influenced by our ability to feel alive in the fun and playfulness of life. If we don't feel that at all, if we feel disconnected from that, then our work's going to suck or be dramatically impacted in some way and won't be live up to its fullest potential. We need to have a balance of those kinds of things and inject that fun spirit, that playful spirit, into the work that we do so that it feels more alive. And so there's this integration that needs to happen with the inner child and the caretaker. And very often people leave that inner child behind because, oh, I have to focus. I have to, you know, do this and do that and, you know, become somebody in this life. So those are just some of my pieces.
Yeah. So many good things that have come up. I feel like it's my responsibility to give people a little bit of like my thought process on video games, because as you both rightly pointed out, it could be a bit of a trap, you know, for people to be like, okay, yeah, this is a form of flow is good for me, I'll buy a video game console, and then, you know, stuff goes wrong. So and it can easily go wrong. So I heard, I don't know how accurate this is, but that Elon Musk has a games console and it's one of his chosen ways to relax, right? So like, that's the kind of perspective that you want to be taking with video games, you know? Like, they are a reward, like a short, like, limited time reward. Like, you don't want to be rewarding yourself in general for anything if you haven't actually done anything. That's like things like pornography. You're rewarding yourself with a super powerful biological reward for like clicking on a desktop. It's like the reward doesn't equal the work that went into it, and it's not balanced, and then all like weird stuff can happen in your brain, same as just playing video games all day without actually doing anything constructive in the world. So having a time limit, for me, I avoid online games that just like suck all your time away and have no end. For me, it's like I try to buy like story based games that have like, you know, this takes 30 hours to complete. You know, it's like, okay, cool, I'll go through it like I would like a series of Game of Thrones or something like that and enjoy the story. And also, in the back of my head, being a little bit meta about it. So, like, even as I'm playing it, kind of, like, laughing at myself, going, like, haha, you're playing a video game. Like, you know, like, if you keep doing this, your whole life is going to disintegrate and you're just going to become, like, a game addict. You know, just have some humor about it. Be realistic about what you're doing and not get like really attached to like, hey guys, did you see how good I was in that video game? Did you see the thing that I picked up? You know, like, don't get so involved in it. So those are just some basics there in related to that. But I do think that if you use it wisely, it can be medicinal. What you were sharing, Mike, about actually getting real games, what came up for me there is the related to social skills. Life is quite complicated. Friendships can be quite complicated. Romantic relationships can be quite complicated. And what can often happen is when you're in a relationship with someone, you're actually playing two different games. you know, you're actually playing two different games. Like, so you could be in a relationship with someone and you've never talked about it, but your unconscious, the unconscious game that you're playing is different from your partner. You know, your values, your aspirations, what you want out of the relationship. But when you're actually playing an actual game with like a series of like rules and considerations, even if you're competing with someone, there's this act of, we're actually weirdly on the same team, even if we're competing, because we've both agreed for this amount of time to limit our behavior within the framework of the game. So if you're playing tennis with someone and you're really trying to beat them, you've unconsciously signed this contract that I'm not going to cheat. I'm not going to use a different type of racket than a tennis racket. I'm not going to hit the ball with a baseball bat. So even though you could be like hating each other in the middle of a tennis game or having a boxing match with someone and trying to beat them, you're not kicking each other, you know? So even if you're trying to beat the person with your fists, on a deeper level, you have to respect the other person for actually competing with you within the framework of the game itself. And that can be like a really bonding experience. So whenever you play games with people, even if it's like in a competitive way, I always feel a lot closer to the person. I think that ties nicely into social skills.
Yeah, one thing, actually, I had a number of things come up there. one is, I think we all agree, like, there's nothing inherently evil about video games. Mm-hmm. I at least want to voice that myself. Big fan, love them, played a whole bunch my whole life. It's just, yeah, a word of caution to the wise. Like anything else, be intentional. You should be intentional about everything in your life and not just be overrun by biology or habit. And I think you touched on a really important point that's been coming up for me a lot with people, at least here at home, is you actually have to take the time to celebrate yourself and give yourself some gratitude and tell yourself that you're doing a fucking good job. Not conditional on the accomplishing that thing 5 years from now. Because when you accomplish that thing 5 years from now, immediately the goalpost will be pushed out again and you will go your entire life without ever feeling like you accomplished anything, because the goalpost always moves. And the way it's been coming up is like, if whatever destination you're going towards is worthy of a celebration, every step along the path that gets you there is also worthy of celebration. So wherever you're at right now, even though you might not be where you want, you actually have to be able to like look at yourself in the mirror and be like, wow, we're doing a good job here. Like, I love you. Great work. And I think for many, certainly for me, it's way harder than it sounds. Way harder than it sounds, because you can see how deep the program of like, oh, I can only be happy and celebrate once I've done this thing. It's always conditional on something else. And it's like, dude, who told you that your value and your happiness was conditional on something? Like, you're not obligated to believe that. That's another obligation. And I say all of that to tie the two together of, yeah, you know, if you had a good day of work, if you had a good week of work, whatever you come to in your balance, like, you should be able to play a video game, go out to a bar, do whatever brings you joy without that background pang of like, oh, I should be working. I can't really enjoy this fully because I know it's wrong. It's like, no, you can do both. Like, yeah, work hard, play hard, but actually be fully in both of them, knowing that you can do both. Yeah.
Yeah. This opens up a lot of really interesting doors. I think it's so deeply conditioned in you know, our society, Western culture, this sense of being like who we are, or our value in the world is framed in terms of our productivity and what, you know, how we engage with the economy. And then that gets translated often into other terms like, oh, well, what can I accomplish? What are the things that I can do? How can I improve and better myself? And these are, to pursue something is not unworthy. It can bring a lot of meaning to life. But the meaning of life is not pursuit itself. There's a deeper song being sung, you know, and the things that we pursue are just notes in that song. And it's important to remember that, because it's easy to just make the whole song, you know, those, the things that we're going after. And like you say, Eric, if we aren't make, if we don't feel like we're making enough progress in that direction, then it, we just beat ourselves up, or we don't give ourselves permission to experience life and really feel valuable or worthy. And there's all kinds of ways that we limit ourselves based on what we conceive of as, you know, if we've reached our achievement quota or whatever it may be. And I think when you think of celebration, you can think of, oh, something happened and now I get to celebrate because this happening is worthy of it. But there's also a deeper recognition, and this is a celebration that is in some ways closer to reverence, but every day is a celebration, and we can participate in the celebration of life as it's unfolding, as it's ongoing, independent of anything that I've done as an individual, anything that I've accomplished. I can go out and be engrossed in the beautiful flower that I'm passing by on my walk, and that can be, fill me with such a rich sense of meaning, even if I felt like I didn't do anything that day. And I think this is an important place to arrive, because it creates a foundation for us to feel nurtured and held by life, and feel it goes back to this coercion piece. If we always feel like we need to achieve in order to deserve or earn a reward, we've basically, you know, we've become domesticated. We're like, you know, dogs, where we give ourselves a treat when we've done the thing that we think we're supposed to do. And there's something about just being alive itself is worthy of celebration. It's worthy of a deep reverence and appreciation that I get to breathe this next breath. And I encourage you, whoever you are, listener, wherever you are in the world, to really give yourself some space to celebrate the fact that you are alive, independent of the difficulty of your circumstances, independent of how challenging things have been or how challenging they might get in the near future. The fact that you are still breathing, and that you could go out and very likely put your feet in the grass or look at the sun or just stand by a tree. There's all of these natural sort of wonders that are so easy to miss when we're in sort of tunnel vision in pursuit of whatever it is at the present time that we feel like we need to catch up to in the future in order to feel good about ourselves. And that future is ever receding. That's the trick. That's why they call it the rat race. It's, you don't actually ever get there. What is a rat race? A rat runs on a wheel, you know? That's what it is. So that's just important to bring that up and really, I don't know, speak into that for a moment, because it's so easy to get lost in accruing the badges of accomplishment that we then wear on top of ourselves to feel worthy, but those badges will never satiate a lack of worth. The lack of worth has to be met and greeted, and you have to arrive at a place where you feel comfortable with your existence without being anybody who accomplishes anything significant in your life at all. If you never did anything meaningful or significant, would you, you know, and that's, when I say that, I mean a certain kind of thing. Like, it's when we think about the things that we can accomplish, it's usually, oh, I started a company, I did this big thing. That significance can be more general than that. You know, the wave to the passerby on your walk today that made a difference for them can be really significant. So, yeah, there's a whole line of thinking to go down there, but I think I've sufficiently kind of walked around this territory. Curious to hear whatever is arising in you guys now.
So yeah, there's as always, like, lots coming up. First of all, Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, I feel like I need to do like a Stoic drop, wisdom drop here. He said, don't enter into games that you can lose. So you can kind of like psychologically rig games so that you can never lose. So if I'm playing a game of tennis, if I decide that the criteria for me winning this game is for me to try my best, then I can still win even if I lose, right? Because if I try my best and I lose, I've still won, according to my definition of winning. So So when you ask, you know, could you be okay? Could you be happy? Could you be content if you didn't accomplish anything? You get to decide what accomplishment is. It doesn't have to be given to you by someone else. So for example, you could set for you, like, the base level of accomplishment is like, I'm going to tell the truth, like, as best as I can. Like, if you can do that, it really doesn't matter then if you've made a lot of money, you know, like, it doesn't really matter then if that's your criteria. I like to tell people when they talk about, you know, when they talk about success, like, how can I be this? How can I do that? One of the things I say is, that the secret to being successful at anything is being okay not having it. So, like, the secret to being a really successful artist is being okay being a failed artist, because then you've won either way. You know, like, you've rigged the game then. It's like, I'm just going to love creating art. That's what I'm going to do. For the next 10 years, I'm just going to create art and I'm going to love every minute of it. You've won. If you're, like, doing it for 10 years, like, one day I'll get a break. It's like, yeah, maybe even if you do, you've just, like, struggled and hated your life for the last 10 years. Is that really, like, is that winning? So, yeah, that comes up for me. You get to decide, like, the rules of the game that you want to play. And from a social perspective, when it comes to, like, celebrating the small wins in life and, you know, the like you were saying, Eric, like, if you have a good day at work or a good week at work, like, you should congratulate yourself and celebrate that. I would ask people listening, if you are not doing that with yourself, how on earth do you ever expect to be doing that with other people? You know, do you really think you can hold space for people who want to celebrate their wins with you when you're not doing it with yourself? I see so much in this space, the self-improvement spirituality space, this addiction to overcoming problems. But the problem is with the addiction to overcoming problems is that you need problems to feed the addiction. So it's like, you're doing well, but you always need there to be a problem for you to overcome it. And you can see this when someone, like, puts out a message like, hey, I'm having a really hard day, need some support. They get flooded, you know, like, people they haven't spoken to for 5 years might hit them up in their inbox. If someone says, like, hey, I've had a really interesting day, I'd love to share some positive news with someone, how many personal messages are they getting? Please share this great news with me. I would imagine a lot less. I think that one of the nicest things ever in a person is you can share good news with them and they celebrate it with you, but you're never going to be that type of person if you can't do that with yourself first.
That's a really important point. This came up in one of our previous dialogues of what a good friend can do. And a good friend, you know, should be able to be there and support you when you're down and want advice. But man, if you really pay attention, it's actually quite difficult to find friends who will deeply celebrate wins with you, mm-hmm. instead of immediately reflecting on their own life and getting jealous and being like, damn, he did this cool thing and I didn't do it. Does that make me less? It's like, can't you just get out of your own head for a second and actually, like, appreciate the fact that your friend, someone you say you care about, had something that they value highly happen to them? It's like, it's actually far more rare than we might expect. And that's a very weird thing. Comes back to the flow and social anxiety stuff. If you were out of your head and in the moment, you would just celebrate with them. So it's funny how this stuff always comes up. I've been chewing on something the past 2 weeks ish that is still not fully developed, but has been shifting a lot in me. So we always want to feel like we do meaningful stuff, like we've contributed to the world and to ourselves, right? And sure, society and culture give us some of their answers as to how we can do that. But if you want to do something significant, I think many could agree on the fact, like, contributing to the evolution of humanity, a pretty good one, right? If you did something to do that, you could consider your life a success. And what's been coming up is, John and I spoke a couple months ago now to this guy named David Krantz, and he was really focused on genetics more specifically epigenetics, how external world stuff actually shapes your genes and your whole biology. And so this reframing has been coming up for me where it's like, yeah, sure, you could create the next Google, right, and make a company. But if you went to a friend and explored deeply with them the things that were troubling them, so much so that you reconciled a lot of it, that would actually change their genetic code. And if they had children, they would pass on like an upgraded genetics to them. And then if you just go through like the generations that would come from that, like you've shifted a large portion, a large percentage of all of humanity. And so I say this all because, like, yeah, we're always really focused on like business success, financial success, because you want to contribute to humanity and feel significant. And it's actually not obvious that just being nice to your family, holding space for your friends, and just saying nice things to people, they could actually be more powerful to contribute to humanity. And actually, I don't think that should be overlooked. Like, there is some wisdom in, like, actually, one of the greatest things you could do is be a nice person to yourself, your immediate relationships, and all the people in the world. And that is extremely important and has a huge, huge ripple effect.
Yep. Yeah, there's something that you're speaking to here, Eric, that invites, like, doesn't necessarily need to be local, but there is a big part of it that can be. That is a real relationship with one's local, proximal environment and a taking on almost like a stewardship of those relationships. And this evokes in me the sense of a different notion of what it means to be a self in the world. There is no such thing as an individual that exists without a world attached to it. That's with the abstract notions we have of Mike and Eric and John. These are like sort of cherry-picked kind of patterns that we compress into something that becomes sort of totalized, and we can reference it as an object, but really it doesn't exist in that abstract form. It can't be plucked out and be comprehensive. We are embedded in the world. We're interacting, and we are shaped by the people around us. We're deeply co-creative in that way, and we're so social. Like our possibilities are limited and expanded based on what those around us think about us, and what kind of ways that they, all these kinds of ways that they relate to us. And this is part of what, for me, I don't seek to care about people because I think that will make me happier or something like that. I care about them because it's a part of me. It's a part of my life. Like my existence is afforded through the interactions that I have. And so I look at it like tree branches. And so if someone comes to me and they want to celebrate something, I'm basically being told there's an announcement of like some progression of the branch. And this is a branch that's connected to me in some deep way. And these are with the relationships that are most intimate to me. But it is a garden, it's an ecology, it's something that I'm not independent from, that it really means a lot when you start to look at it this way. And there's a lot of, when we go back to the achievement stuff, a lot of people want to accomplish great things. And then at the end, there's all of these ways that our stories are told, these narratives of these people who accomplish such great things, Steve Jobs and George Washington or whatever these individuals are. Now, the way that we tell the stories, though, draws forward a main character and pushes into the background all of these people who were probably much more than supporting roles. You could make them main characters in their own stories as well. So all of the ways that we think about these valiant individuals can miss a lot of the background commotion that was actually vital, necessary ingredients to the success of that individual. You see, we just like our heroes, and the idea of a heroic collective is probably harder to digest because the complexity of the interactions, it's not as simple as a story, you know, a monomyth architecture of a kind of story. And I'll say one more thing that's related to what you were speaking to, John, and it's a personal motto that I came up with some time ago, and it is craft over status, art over praise. And it's this relationship, like you're speaking to, if I suck as an artist, but I enjoy every day of creating that art, even if no one else appreciates it, I'll take that. I'll take that over being a world famous artist and hating creating what I like. If I don't enjoy the process of making those works and I'm world famous, I don't want it. I would rather hold on and retain the focus on craft and mastery, the focus on actually creating the art and not being concerned with status and praise. These are things that put it in other people's hands, the meaningfulness of it. And I'll still accept praise and accept advances in status, but I will not sacrifice the care for the craft and the care for the art. Those things have to be the prerequisite. They have to come before the seeking of the status or the praise, because otherwise all those works are empty in some ways. They lose something vital that would actually make them that would carry sort of a part of your soul or something. So I just voice that because it's a very compact way of thinking about that kind of relationship, you know, to the things that we do, to the activities. I want to be right in front of it, enjoying it, and not be caught up in, oh, what will people say? What will they think of me when I've done this amazing thing? Less concerned about that, more concerned about what it means to me in the moment that it's happening. And that, I think, affords a flow state, because it's so easy to then get the judgmental, critical, interfering thoughts coming in that can have a larger and louder voice because we're placing the value of doing the thing on those voices and not on the doing itself. So I'll just let that one simmer for a bit.
Yeah, I just have a really quick addition to underscore this, because this is a fundamental, foundational point here. There's almost like a law in the fabric of the world where you actually have to let go of the outcome first, and then you can get the real outcomes from that. But it starts at not needing it, which everyone's been alluding to here. The analogy I really love is a very needy person trying to get in a relationship with someone. If you really need that person, and you're like obsessed and you're always messaging them, it actually becomes less and less and less attractive, which makes it more and more likely that it'll never actually happen. But if you can show up from a space of, well, no, I don't need you, I'm not dependent on it, but I would like to do this, it's way more attractive. But it starts with, oh, I actually don't need this to work out the way I want it. I would like it to, but it's not a requirement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I find this like idea of neediness to be like a really powerful metaphor in life in general, because neediness can come up in relationships, but just like it comes from a place of scarcity, right? Like, as opposed to abundance. That's the fundamental difference. If you feel abundant, like you could have unlimited partners that you love, or you have access to that, then what would be the need to be needy? You know, this comes from like, I can't ever replace this person. This person is one of a kind. This is forever. This is my soulmate. I've ruined it. And then like all the neediness kind of seeps in. And I believe in the domain of relationships, only can you have a really healthy relationship when you are comfortable with it ending. That's just like very basic, you know, when I see the best relationships, it's like if my partner lied to me, then I break up with them. It's like, yeah, but you've been with them 10 years and you have a house together. And it's like, yeah, but you know, that's just my boundary. That is a healthy relationship. Not, they cheated on me 10 times and I kept having them back. You know, that's that's not, you know, that's not really love. That's neediness, and that's exactly what you're gonna find in really poor relationships. It's like that Fight Club quote: "Only when you've lost everything are you free to do anything." Something like that, right? I think that's it. But it's when you can let go of something, then you can you've got access to all these new possibilities and potentials.
Yeah, that I find that to be quite true. It reminds me of the song by 38 Special, "Hold On Loosely," because if you grip anything too tightly, you start to crush it, you start to kill it. And there's something about neediness that I think is naturally repulsive to people, because it's asking someone to do something for you that only you can really do for yourself in some way. There's this asking that person to fill something that you have to encounter, and you, like, the individual has to see the black hole that they're trying to get this other person to fill, and recognize that that person could never actually fill it and satisfy it. It could only temporarily alleviate the clamoring of and the noise of that thing in your system. And I think there's coming at peace with being alone, being, you know, sometimes I consider the possibility of dying alone, not from this perspective of never finding anyone to love, but dying, actually dying alone, dying by myself where no one else is around me, which is a possibility. And many human beings have died in this manner. And then when you start to, you know, when I do die, when that day comes, I'm not going to be walking that path with anyone else, even if there are other people in the room. There isn't someone I'm with in that, you know, dark hallway to whatever lies beyond. You know, it's a place we need to walk ourselves, and I think there is some recognition of that's needed to have. There's in some ways, yeah, I can see a beautiful interconnection and inseparability with this world, but there's also a fundamental isolation or something like this, where no one can know me as I know me in the most intimate ways. You know, even if it's the closest person to me in the world, there's so much that they've missed, and there's so much that they just don't see because they're not in touch with the sensory inputs that I'm experiencing and the cascade of emotions and all of the events that I find meaningful for particular reasons. You know, you can't bring someone up to speed on really knowing you at the depth that you know yourself. And that lends itself to some degree of isolation. You know, no one can ever know us as richly. Other individuals can reflect things to us that help us know ourselves better, but they always have a lower resolution picture of who you are that they're working with. And I think this is, you know, in some ways good to accept, because some people have it feels like a faulty expectation that their partners or their people in their lives know everything about them and know all the ins and outs. And without that, it's not a real connection. And that's just foolish. You can't expect to have that. So there's something about bridging this deep interconnection and this sense of isolation. And there is something ironically connective about the fact that we all experience that isolation. I might not know the contents and the difficulty and the nature of the isolation that anyone who is listening to this feels, but the fact that we all feel it to some degree is connective in a strange way. So yeah, man, it's so interesting to zoom out for a second. You know, when we hop in these conversations, you know, we had four terms to get started with, and now we're riding this raft, and it's just weird the places that we go and the places that we come to. And I'm noticing myself just being on this ride and listening to what the things are that John and Eric say, and seeing what they enliven in me that feel useful and important, but maybe not common. And And yeah, I just have to say I'm enjoying the kind of the places that we go in these conversations and the things that they elicit in myself, because I'm noticing I'm articulating things that I haven't put into words in quite this way before, and that's a really fun exercise for me.
It's funny you say that right now, because I was actually going to bring this back to where we started, because it seems, or it feels like, that this the notion of clinging and letting go, and you could do any polarity there, rigidity, looseness, right? It seems like that's a candidate for one of the things at the center of the overlapping Venn diagram that we started with, right? Because it affects all four of the flow, play, depression, social anxiety, social success, right? This letting go, this openness, way more conducive to flow and play. It brings the lightness. It can help you avoid depression. It can make you more responsive to social skills. And of course, the opposite can induce them. Rigidity, obligation, requirements bring you out of flow. They make it way more serious, so you can't even play. They're way more likely, because you're not getting expectations met, that you'll be depressed or become depressed, and they'll make your relationships and your connectedness to people awkward or more difficult or a stress rather than giving you energy. So it seems like the whole clinging notion is one of the things that can fit in the Venn diagram. I knew there was some way these four were related, and it seems like we're stumbling around closer to some viable candidates.
Yeah. You just brought up for me these two types of happiness that I've noticed in people. You know, like, so you, on the one hand, I see people who are quote unquote happy, who seem to be very extrovert and talkative, social, and high energy, you know, like the typical bubbly personality. But then there's this other type of person that I have met, and it's they're much more like calm and like zen, and you get a sense that their happiness comes from not needing things, you know. And there's quite an important distinction there between these two types of contentment. One is like, oh my god, the world's a playground. And then the other one is more like, I actually don't need anything right now. This is fine. Like, sorry, we don't have your favorite ice cream. Okay. No problem. You know, like that, there's a certain kind of like happiness and contentment in that. And in sort of like the Stoics would say, wanting the thing, learning to want the things you already have. You know, like you can always choose in any moment to actually want this reality as it is.
Dude, that's actually so funny you say that. Literally last week I heard this story, and the details might be a little sparse, but there's this painting, or there's this image of like a sage, whatever term you want to use there, enlightened person sitting, and they have this jewel in their hand, and the jewel symbolized, it was something that would grant you whatever you wanted, right? Whatever you did, like a genie's lamp. And there was this conflict, right? It's like, why would a person who has renounced the world be in possession of this thing that would give you whatever you want? And the thing that came up was, well, of course he always gets what he desires, because he only desires what is and what is happening. And in that way, he always gets it. And that, I think, is such a cheeky but beautiful way to say it. It's like, well, if you only actually want and desire whatever's going to unfold, you will always get what you want and you will always be satisfied. Because to Mike's point earlier, just the fact that this is happening is enough. And we've even said this on other dialogues, like just the fact that you're alive is more than enough. The container itself is entirely satisfactory. Everything else that unfolds within it is a bonus. And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that came up for me last week, and you just brought it up too.
Yeah, that's a cool one.
This makes me want to speak to the... because I can empathize with people who may hear that. You know, this is enough. Just sort of as a start, like as the starting point, you know, without having acquired or done any like X, Y, or Z with one's life. And I think what that points me to, what it makes me want to encourage people to examine is there are lots of ways that we're conditioned to believe that we need certain things. You know, we look at the modern way that, you know, we live in a consumerist society, basically. And there's advertising that points us to all these ways that we ought to be different, or that things that we need, and they're very good at it. They're very good at it. There was, you know, there's Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, wrote a book called Propaganda, and it was all about basically this idea, this notion of creating a consumer society in which we sell things to people and you know, create these needs and these wants in them and get them to buy it. And this term fell out of favor, propaganda, after it was associated with the Nazis, and they began using the term public relations. And so there's all kinds of ways that we've been programmed into believing that there are things we need to do, things we're missing, all that kind of stuff that keeps us from touching on an imperturbable sense of wholeness and a deep meaningfulness for existence itself. And this is an experience that a lot of people may never have, maybe in the heights of a peak experience, you know, where they feel completely like they've submerged with the world around them, or some kind of psychedelic experience. You might encounter this, and it's just, I want to encourage people to examine the beauty that surrounds them. You know, like if there's a child that is in your life somewhere, a baby, just the fact that happens, you know, there's so much that we take for granted, we just accept because it's so common. It's just, I think I've probably brought this up before. How is it that I say it? You know, things that are pervasive become indetectable. It's not usually how I phrase it, but when something is everywhere, it's like we don't see it because there isn't anything to break it up. The fact that birth happens just seems like, yeah, that's a thing. But what? You know, like, wait, this is how it all works. And then there's like a life that comes out of another life. And this is how it's been going on for all of this time. And you can go outside, and I'm looking out my window right now, and I see trees, and I see two different shades of trees. They're beautiful. There are flowers you could probably find nearby you somewhere too. And that's just, these are like as cliche as it gets. Like I'm not doing the heavy lifting for you. Like there's other things you can look at. The wood grain on the desk that I'm using, the plants that are sitting on the desk. You know, a lot of this stuff can be accessed through nature, but it can even be appreciated through the way that you witness the emergence of your own thoughts and the elegance of that process. It can get so, there's all these different places you can begin to point your attention and appreciate this world. And I think this world needs greater appreciation because there's this sense that I have that people try to change this world coming from a place of hatred. And it doesn't seem to me that that's an effective place to stand as you're trying to create a different world, because it causes you to miss so many things. And I think that then there we'll find ourselves sacrificing things we really didn't want to sacrifice because we became so hardened by our hatred that we forgot to appreciate things that actually mattered. So I just invite people to really allow yourself to experience the beauty of existence. And as like, it's there, it's like right there in your environment. It's around you. We become so jaded, but we have an incredible ability to sense, touch, smell, taste, sight, it's just what's the fusion of those things, the richness of the detail that we can ingest and the meaning that we can generate, the beauty that we can perceive is really amazing. It's a privilege to be inhabiting a human body, to be able to get to do that. And if you can do this on the small levels, imagine how good it will feel to mountain bike down that hill at raging speeds, or to have sex with this person that you're really falling for the first time. You know, the invigoration that you can experience when you actually begin to appreciate the beautiful moments. And there's so much that arises in our life that has nothing to do with our own planning. It's just a gift. And I think sometimes it's easier for us to appreciate the things that we worked hard to bring into our life. And maybe we don't give enough space for the things that life just decides, or the things that just arise into our experience, that person that comes out of nowhere, the character that gets written into the plot of your life that you completely did not anticipate. So much of our life story is built on those gifts that blindside us and end up taking our course, the mythology of our life, in an entirely different direction. So I could go on and on about this, but I think if I could leave you with something, not that we're going to end this conversation, but leave you with something on this particular stream, is if you're outside walking around, or go outside, even if it's raining, like go out in the rain, like no excuses, just find something that's beautiful somewhere near you and appreciate it. Allow yourself to build that muscle. It enables you to experience a richness that most people don't allow themselves to experience because they're so preoccupied with what they believe they ought to be doing with their time and with their life, and feel like they can't appreciate until, and that until never ends.
Building on, I love that. Building on what you are talking about with beauty, Mike. I think the Buddhists and other sages throughout history have recognized that a large part of our reality is up for grabs. You know, things don't have to be just as they are. So for example, if you think that compassion is a nice trait and it makes you feel good, you can actively build compassion through the right intentions and daily practice, you know, and you can build it to an extremely high degree, to the level of like feeling like you're on MDMA, you know, like I'm sure that really well-practiced loving kindness meditators are able to conjure up in themselves MDMA-like feelings just through the power of their intention over the years that they've been practicing. So when it comes to seeing more beauty in the world, it's not a case of like, okay, I need to move somewhere that's more beautiful. As you were saying, it's a case of like consciously deciding, you know, this month or this week or today, I'm going to increase my capacity to experience beauty. And you make the decision. You set the intention. I'm going to look for beauty today. I'm going to Google art images. I'm going to learn about artists. I'm going to read poetry. Like, I haven't read poetry for years, but I'm going to read a poem today and really savor it. You can go on an adventure tomorrow that you were completely blind to because you felt like you just had to have tomorrow as being a replica of today. But tomorrow can be a much more beautiful day, even if you're in the same place, by just choosing to build your capacity to experience beauty. And I think that, keep that in mind, really important. Reality is up for grabs.
That's so empowering. To really let that land, that's so empowering to know that you can do that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is also bringing up what I nodded to earlier about the obligation thing, right? You're under no obligation to take on the value structure of your culture, your society, whatever. Like, you're free to do that. But there's also an important point of reprogramming your nervous system and your psyche is difficult. There is a lifetime of momentum pushing you forward, right? And like a challenge you could do is like this weekend, host a party just to celebrate nothing. And immediately, I bet you'll notice this weird thing in your stomach come up where it's like, well, I didn't do anything. And it's like, yo, super easy to sit here and nod your head and be like, yeah. You know, I should just celebrate the thing. But to actually get to the point where you fully believe that and embody that, it can be challenging. This is the This is the classic metaphor of why some of this work is always talked about as like a path. Because, wow, you could technically, and I think Zen talks about this a lot, you could technically drop it all at a moment's notice. But to stop something that is moving with a great amount of force and momentum is actually very difficult. It's possible, but it's very difficult. And you're probably better to slow it down slowly and get to a point where the momentum doesn't matter and you can walk away. But it's like, yes, I was sitting here nodding to everything you guys was like, yeah. But to go out and do that, to actually act it, you know, the second you ask a friend to come over to your party to celebrate nothing and they're like, yeah, but what's it for? And you immediately snap back into the old habitual pattern, like, yo, deconditioning that is a process. But what lies on the other side is freaking beautiful and amazing all the time. So it is worth the effort to get there. Or I think to a lot of this, actually just the act of trying, the act of putting in that effort itself is beautiful. It doesn't even matter if you get there, but just the pursuit of beauty, the pursuit of experience, the pursuit of life in itself is beautiful, regardless of where you end up.
Yeah. Thinking about this party and how that can be such an, you know, the more a person begins to see things that once felt really solid and inalterable as very much living inside of the heads of all the humans around and can very much be changed and shaped. It doesn't exist like concrete in the world. It's you know, part of the cultural substrate that people treat as fixed reality. But when you start to see that that's not the case and you can begin to celebrate nothing or whatever it may be that deviates from the prevailing, you know, paradigm that the people around you are kind of operating from, you can begin to enter into a playful, almost like jester-like sort of disposition where you can like almost gleefully invite people into playing outside the bounds, like of what they've been taught they need to play inside of. What do they say? You know, color outside the lines, but in a beautiful way. It doesn't need to be chaos. It can be beauty that is built outside of the confines of what people tell you you need to, you know, how you need to be playing and operating. And there's something electrifying when you feel like you can do that, because you get to like break out of the cultural matrix to some degree. You know, good luck completely separating yourself from its influence altogether, but you certainly can become an agent for a different kind of influence. That's the thing, is we all make up the fabric of the culture and this web of influence that we're all exposed to. And there are cascade effects, similar to what you were describing earlier with the epigenetics. There are these cascade effects that we can act in certain ways, invite certain things out of the people around us, and it can create, you know, a lot of downstream changes. So, yeah, I mean, when I think about playfulness and all of this kind of stuff, you know, for one thing, I'll speak. If you feel depressed right now, that's totally okay, because there's a lot going on in the world, and it's really confusing, and. Sometimes we go through patches in our life where we feel depressed, and that's part of the narrative arc of our experience. We're going through a deeper cut. We're making our way through a valley, and pay attention to how it feels there and what that's like. And you know, this too shall pass. You know, let that ring in your ears as well, so you don't unnecessarily apply eternalism to the state that you're in, and you recognize that this is something that is impermanent and you will feel differently someday. And then also, what, you know, invite in the small steps that you could take that take you in a different direction or invite a different kind of experience. Call up a friend. Decide you want to play a game. Decide you want to have a game night. Decide you want to, you know, pick up an old hobby, you know, bring something back that was of a former life that you had, and you want to revisit it. There's all kinds of things that you can do. But I think it's important that, you know, if you are feeling depressed or down, you know, there's always this next moment to make a choice that could lead you to feeling differently. But also there might be some medicine or some wisdom in the sensations that you're experiencing right now. And maybe there's something waiting to be cracked open, waiting to be revealed to you. It's not that you can't or aren't supposed to feel depressed. Sometimes there's good reason we feel it, and there's something we need to learn or recognize or witness in that space. So, yeah.
I haven't really touched much on depression. It's such a big topic because there are so many causes. You know, you can have, you know, people with like a lot of trauma, like years of trauma, that could be like one source. You could have people that don't know, you know, it's just like unexplained, just like low mood, and that's another thing. I think doing some sort of like depression inventory online, like finding a good one, like a reputable one, and doing it just to check your own levels of depression, I think that's a good idea. And for anxiety as well, if you have that, just so you kind of know what you're working with. It's quite useful to be like, okay, cool, I guess I have mild anxiety right now, like, oh, I have like mild depression this week. Okay, cool, I'm not like too much, I'm not too low. Or if it's really strong, you know, that can give you a little bit of guidance, like, okay, what should I be doing based on the result of that. But yeah, I can't really talk much about depression in a general sense, but what I do want to talk about is stress-induced depression. And that's a very specific type of depression that can come just from being too stressed. Like if you experience stressful events over and over and over again, which many of us have in this pandemic, you know, not being able to socialize, not being able to have play, not being able to have flow, not being able to go to the coffee spots that we like, whatever it is, not being able to train in a gym, if that's your thing, not being able to go to the cinema. Maybe you feel like stressed. Maybe you're bound up with your family or something like that. Or maybe you've been confined with your partner and you just feel stressed. And if that keeps going, you know, you will experience depression. That's actually quite normal. And so, yeah, I just, rather than talk about depression, I want everyone to take a look at the levels of stress and what are you doing for it? Like this very basic stuff, like you need to exercise, you need to get your heart rate high, you need to have good sleep, and you need to really just chill out sometimes. Like you really just need days off, having parties, doing nothing, giving hugs, like having a whole day, like I'm not going to do anything today. I'm going to go on vacation, whatever it is. So yeah, let's not be like too much in the David Goggins camp. I'm a huge fan of David Goggins, the ultra marathon Navy SEAL runner. Huge fan of him, but he seems very stressed. And the fact that he has to now stretch for 2 hours every night just to keep his body functional gives evidence to that too. So, yeah, let's unwind as much as we work on ourselves.
And let that unwinding not be so that we can hit the court the next day, refreshed. The unwinding isn't doesn't exist for the purposes of making the work better. It exists because it ought to exist in its own right. The idea that we need to only relax so that we can be refreshed for when we have to visit our work the next day or whatever it may be, is so it's all cobbled up with this idea that we're just cogs in a machine and we just need to be productive out in the world. You deserve to take a break and relax. And if you feel like you can't do that, you might, maybe you need, there's a dash of creativity where you could really think it through, and there's probably a way of doing it. Or you feel like, oh, the whole world would fall apart if I wasn't holding on to all this stress. There's a lot of ways we can become addicted to or even identified with the stress and almost wear it as a badge of honor. I've seen a lot of people in startup culture and things like that get very much hooked on feeling stressed as an indicator that they're moving in the right direction, you know, and this is good time. It's good to know that you can operate under pressure, but to do that, you know, enduringly with no end in sight is not a recipe for a life well lived, in my opinion. I feel like we've touched on some interesting points, and you know, I appreciate people for listening as we've been careening down these interesting sort of rivers and valleys of thought and heart. And I'd love to hear if you guys have some parting words. But first, I'd just like to, you know, to just speak into, you know, whoever might be listening, the possibility of change in your life. And it can come from nowhere. It can come completely out of the blue. That can really bring, you know, new meaning to your life. And sometimes it means you have to expose yourself to something new. You got to play a game. You got to strike up a conversation with someone and interact with them and, you know, maybe make a new friend or, you know, do that thing that really you have to be so focused that it pulls you entirely into the moment and gives you that sense of that rush, that sense of being alive. You know, all of these things, there's so many different ways you can sort of flesh it out, and we could come up with hundreds of activities you could do, but I just encourage you to arrive at something and just go out and do it. Practice injecting some novelty into your life. Just break out of the way that you tend to do things. Go hop in a cold shower and tell me you don't feel alive after doing that for just a minute, you know? There's all kinds of things that you can do to just inject a little bit of something different, a different kind of spice, and just see what that does and make it a practice of doing something like that. And very quickly, I think the world can open up in ways that are hard to anticipate from where you're sitting right now.
It's really nice to be back, having these discussions, having these dialogues. We've had some really good feedback from these, which really warms my heart, and looking forward to keeping this going and having more conversations and getting you guys, the listeners, to give input and feedback and maybe choosing some topics that you'd like us to discuss. We've talked about flow and social skills, depression and play. The thing I want to leave you with is you can, if you choose, turn your entire life into a sort of game, into a sort of work of art, if you will. If you played role play games, you'll often, you know, go on some quest and then you meet some wizard and the wizard's got like a little side quest for you and you go pick up a sword or something. You know, we've all played these games. Well, your friends can be those characters in the game, you know? Like if your friend gets excited about a TV show or a book or an idea, that's like a little side quest. Like, go check it out, you know? I personally have been really liking this idea of seeing the universe, the world, my social world as this like web of opportunity, and it's my job to dig out the gems. So I'm always looking like, what is this situation trying to encourage in me? It's like, ah, cool, it was trying to tempt me. It was trying to bring out some discipline. Ah, nice, okay, cool. Oh, wow, this person, I feel a bit of envy towards their physique. What do you do? Oh, I do calisthenics. Ah, okay, great, I'm gonna start doing that. Thanks. You know, like seeing everything as this opportunity, this like the game-like flow experience, and I'm really enjoying it that way, you know, rather than being too structured, like planning the next year. It's more like this very conversation, I'm going to be thinking about it and thinking like, what was discussed here that is going to influence my week next week? You know, one of those would be beauty. You know, beauty has come up and I've realized like I love beauty, but I never dedicate time simply to beauty. So that's something I'm going to be doing this week. I'm going to be looking up art. I'm going to be going for walks and looking at the mountains and just doing nothing other than just staring at nature for a while. I'm excited to do that. And I wouldn't have done that if we hadn't talked about it today. So thank you for that.
Yeah, that point of everything has signal, I think is really important, and that's worth exploring. It's just a useful frame. Mm-hmm. What if everything was sending me a message? And the dependency on that is you have to listen way more than you probably do now, and you have to reflect, right? So you got to make the time to do that, time to listen and time to reflect. And yeah, there are practices, you know. I feel like this has become a hobby horse of mine, but I bring it up so much because it seems to be such a beautiful solution to all these things that come up, which is, and I'll put the article in the show notes for this, but I have written about and practicing a tea practice where you really just be super present with making tea and consuming it. And yeah, if you can imbue something so mundane with presence and beauty and grace and connection with nature, like that ripples out into your life so substantially. And so you can do that with anything. You can do that with making paintings. You can do that with conversations. You can do that with writing. Like for you, it can look like anything, but I think what this conversation has got at is it's important that you have something that does that for you. Connection with beauty, connection with the world around you, self-expression. It doesn't matter necessarily what that is for you, but it matters a lot that you actually have an outlet like that. So find one if you don't.
Great. Well, this was riveting discussion. More dialogues to come in the future. And yeah, just always a pleasure to sit down with you guys and riff and jam and explore the territory of what's alive in our psyches. And yeah, hopefully if you're listening, you found this useful. We've got tons of great stuff coming down the pipe for High Existence. And there is so much that is on the site right now. Go to highexistence.com. You can see there's tons of articles, tons of past podcasts. If you enjoyed listening to this, listen to one of our previous dialogues, listen to the other podcasts where we bring guests on the show. There's just so much richness that has been accrued over 10 years of High Existence being alive. So yeah, dive on in, go down a rabbit hole and, you know, tell us what you find along the way. Great to have you, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the High Existence Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would really help us if you left a review, left a rating, left a comment, just reached out to us, shared it with your friends. Anything like that can help us continue to doing the work that we love, speaking with great minds, speaking between ourselves and creating these really thought-provoking and ultimately useful conversations. Thank you very much.